Welcome to the Reformed Media Review. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here with visiting a professor of history at Hillsdale College, Dr. Daryl Hart, our good friend. And we're going to be speaking today about a new book by Owen Strand titled Awakening the Evangelical Mind, an Intellectual History of the Neo-Evangelical Movement. It's published by Zondervan. Well, first, Daryl, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Camden. It's good to be back.
Yeah, we love getting you on the program. I received this book in the mail, and I read it, and I thought immediately we absolutely have to speak with Daryl about this one and get his take on it. Just can you set the stage for our listeners, Daryl? What is this book all about?
Well, it is about that neo-evangelical movement, the progressive fundamentalists, if that's not an oxymoron, but that's fundamentalists coming out of the 30s thought fundamentalism was too narrow and negative, and they wanted to portray a conservative Protestantism in a more positive light. And they began to found a variety of institutions. But the figures who were important to this book and important to that movement as well were people who had PhDs, people like Harold John Ockenguy, who had been at Park Street Church in Boston and then at a couple of pastorates in Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh and then Park Street.
He thought about leaving, but then stayed.
Right. Yeah. He was the first president of Fuller Seminary when that was founded in 1947, eventually became a president of Gordon Conwell at the end of his career. Carl Henry is in this book as well. He was not – I can't remember where he did his PhD. He wrote a lot in a lot of different contexts. His most serious work was defending the authority of Scripture and the inerrancy of Scripture.
Mm.
But he was the original editor, well, not the original, but one of the founding editors of Christianity Today. He also taught at Fuller Seminary, responsible for part of the founding generation of the Evangelical Theological Society. So there's an intellectual component to what these progressive fundamentalist neo-evangelicals were doing. The poster boy, who really is only has a cameo appearance in the book a couple times because he's not really an intellectual or an academic, is Billy Graham. But Graham was very much a part of this movement. He was on the board at Fuller. I think he was on the board at Gordon Conwell. So he was a friend of Ockenguy. He was also an editor part of the editorial oversight at Christianity Today. So Graham is very much connected to all this, even though he's doing something quite different.
Mm-hmm.
So Strand is unearthing this world again and constructing it as as people who are responsible for awakening, as the title indicates, the evangelical mind. Now this material has been worked over, and this isn't his fault. I mean, it's in some ways a popular book with a trade press, Zondervan, so he's not necessarily expected to do first-rate research here.
Well, it is at the same time being presented, as you hear even in the flap, an indispensable study of evangelicalism. Strand's work makes a serious contribution to intellectual history by way of social history, shedding light on an entire movement. And I very much enjoyed the book, and I had taken it as a serious book, but one...
Right.
Not for scholars, but in many ways, the press about it, seems to be presented as some kind of a
which is
a
unfortunate
scholarly.
Because I presume Strand had less of a hand in that.
Yeah.
At least I want to think that, because I mean, Mark Knoll's book on evangelical biblical scholarship, Between Two Worlds or whatever, I can't remember the name of it. But it's about the emergence of an evangelical biblical scholarship, but from old Princeton through Westminster to Fuller and then ETS circles and debates over inerrancy, which covers a lot of this ground. And it's called Between Faith and Criticism. Mark Knoll's book came out in, I think, 87 or so.
Mm.
And George, about the same time, George Marsden's 40th anniversary History of Fuller came out in 86 or so. And that's a first rate. It's,
it's
I think it may
it's
be
brilliant.
one of Marsden's best books because he's such a good storyteller. And this is an really remarkable story. So there have been forerunners to this book that I think readers, listeners should not forget. And they would be good supplements, or maybe Strand is in some ways a supplement to those older works.
Hmm. Let's talk about some of the figures here. He's trying to bring to the fore, and he does it in an interesting way. I really enjoyed reading this book. It raised a lot of questions for me. The big figure that he begins with is, as you mentioned earlier, is Harold J. Ockengay. He was a pastor for many, many years at Park Street Church in Boston. He also was highly influential in Fuller and just in evangelicalism in general, did a lot of things. Let's speak about him. He was at Princeton for a while before moving over to Westminster, isn't that right?
Yes. So he comes out of a Holiness Wesleyan background, which is a whole nother issue that I think we need at some point to talk about things that Strand left out. And
yeah.
and again, it's unfortunate when reviews of books talk about a book that the author should have written but didn't, and that's in some ways unfair. But the story is in some ways more complicated, and it could have been a much more compelling story, maybe even a much more instructive one, which I think is part of what Strand wants to accomplish, had he left in more of the warts. So the reason we're bringing this up is that there's a great debate that was going on 20 years ago between Don Dayton, who was librarian at Asbury Seminary and then Northern Baptist Seminary. Hmm. He and Marsden were graduate students together at Yale. And Dayton always faulted Marsden for only telling the Calvinist side of evangelical history. And Dayton wanted to foreground the Holiness Wesleyan side of this. And he would point to someone like Ockengay as a chief example of this, because Ockengay comes out of a Methodist background. He goes to a Wesleyan school, Taylor University in Upland, Indiana. And then somewhere the intellectual lights turn on, and so he gets counsel to go to Westminster, Princeton, where Machen is, of course, a big name because of his prominence in the controversies over liberalism and fundamentalism there and in the broader Protestant world. And when he's there at a time when the controversy and the reorganization of Princeton is happening, and Machen founds Westminster in 1929, and Ockengay, to his credit, goes along. I think he was pretty loyal to Machen. Machen helped him, as did Clarence McCartney, mm-hmm. A board member at Westminster, a prominent conservative Presbyterian pastor. They helped give Ockengay advice about pulpits in the Presbyterian Church. One of the things that I think is curious about this, though, is that when the pulpit came up open at Park Street, both Ockengay and Machen advise Ockengay to take it. Now, this is reading between the lines,
yeah,
perhaps too much, but if Machen really thought that Ockengay was going to be an ally in very contested battles by the 1930s when this is happening, I mean, Machen needs all the allies he can get in the Presbyterian conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's recommending that one of his former students go take a pulpit outside the church, you know, maybe they thought, here's a really gifted man. He would probably work much better in another context, a congregational setting in Boston, kind of an independent church, as it were. You know, so and Strand doesn't really explore that, and I haven't seen anyone really explore that. But anyway,
well, that was the main question I had for you, because there's a segment in the book which, in one sense, seems to interpret Machen's actions and reading some of his correspondence as Machen being some sort of an evangelical power broker, where he's looking at all the available pulpits and he's finding, you know, the people mm-hmm. that he thinks are going to, you know, provide the most cultural or perhaps even ecclesiastical influence, and then moving those pieces around like a master general and placing guys in pulpits. And it seemed as if some of his correspondence to Ockengay was cast in that direction. And
right.
I was wondering what, you know, well, you've already expressed your thoughts on that. But
well, I mean, Machen was because he was such a prominent figure, he did receive a huge volume
mm-hmm.
of inquiries from people seeking advice. So that makes a lot of sense. And you know, one other wrinkle that hasn't I've never pursued. I've wanted to. I still have some copies of some of the documents, but A.Z. Conrad, the previous preacher pastor at Park Street, who was a pretty formidable figure in his own right. He was a friend of Machen's. He supported Machen. He had Machen come up there and speak at Park Street, preach, I'm pretty sure. And there, roughly this time, there was a merger between Harvard and Andover seminaries. The main hall, the main building at Harvard Divinity School to this day is Andover Hall, which goes back to that merger in the mid-1920s. Now, Conrad was part of conservative Congregationalists in Massachusetts who opposed that merger on the grounds that Andover was formed precisely in opposition to the Unitarianism that was transpiring at Harvard back in 1805 or so. And so, and I think, I'm pretty sure the courts ruled in favor of this claim against the merger, so that Andover had to go its separate direction, and Harvard went a separate direction, even though for a time there was enough of a merger there that they could name a hall at Harvard Divinity after Andover. And I'm still not sure how the library holdings worked in all that. I think there are still books in the Harvard Divinity School library that come from that merger. Now, Westminster and Machen are important in this because Conrad was actually looking for a way to get Andover's endowment to move that, with the courts ruled favorably, to Westminster. He was actually not necessarily looking for a merger of the two institutions as much as wanting the resources,
the assets,
you know, right, to go to Westminster, which
right.
was just starting at the time. So, you know, that's that's another way in which you could possibly construe Machen as some kind of power broker, but in fact, it was much more Conrad who was trying to orchestrate things. So anyway, I think Machen was a prominent figure. He had clout, but I still think that Strand misses the dimension of the, or at least trying to account for why Machen would let somebody go from conservative circles in the PCUSA mm-hmm. at a time when he needed all the votes he could get.
Now, at the time, was Machen's kind of theology and personal appropriation of the pilgrim motif present, or is that something that developed later in his life? I mean, at the time, early on, when he's in the midst of these battles at this stage of the game, is he still seeking influence or at least some cultural victories? Or I'm wondering, you know, if we look back at him now in a way maybe Charlie Dennison would read him, if that wasn't present at this stage but developed later.
Well, not to sound like a broken record, but I'm sure I've said this to you before in some of our conversations, that I think the turning point for Machen was the World War One, the Great War.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the destruction there and seeing Western civilization destroyed.
So that's much earlier than this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think coming back from the war, he's much more mindful now of a sober estimate of things. But then by the time he loses Princeton, if you look at his the end of his address about Westminster Seminary, his convocation address, what it stands for, et cetera. There's a sound of lament at the end of that about why God would let this institution that had stood for so long go. And he says, perhaps we were too contented, perhaps we were too respectable, and there's a sense in which he's gearing up, even in 1929, that, you know, we've got to choose a different path.
Mm-hmm.
Then it can't be from one of power.
Prestige,
and perhaps wealth as much as one, or the establishment, cultural mm-hmm. establishment, as one from some kind of alternative. And I've wanted to write about this for a while on the blog, and I haven't done it, but, you know, there's this Benedict option that Rod Dreher is talking about a lot. It's getting a lot of attraction.
Mm.
And I wanted to counter that with the Machen option, because Machen founding Westminster, you know, and eventually founding the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions, eventually a new communion with the OPC, you know, that's a different kind of option as well. You're still part of the world, as it were. You're not, Benedict connotes a monastery and a separation from the world. Machen's still a part of it, but it's going to be kind of in a ghetto-like institutional model. These are going to be institutions on the sidelines, but still institutions that are going to sustain, as you put it, a pilgrim community.
Hmm. How does Akinge relate to Machen as the years go on? Of course, Machen passes away not too late, too far
right
after this, but in the intermediate time, how do they correspond?
I don't recall it real well. So it would be silly for me to try to recall things I looked at 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it was cordial. I mean, I think the point that that Strand, you know, I think could that Marsden actually makes in his book about Fuller. Akinge and someone else who comes up late in the book, John Gerstner, who went to Westminster. Trying to think who else. But it wasn't so much that Westminster was a model for these men and the kind of academic work that Westminster people were doing was a model. It was the old Princeton model. And that's something I think Noel brings out really forcefully in his book on evangelical biblical scholarship, that old Princeton represented, you know, it was an older strand of Protestant divinity going back to the early 19th century, which in some ways aspired back to the Geneva Academy, even, you know, by assigning Turton or whatever. But you know, the seminaries were a new institution. No one in Europe was doing something like that. If you wanted to be a minister in Europe, you went to university and studied there.
Mm-hmm.
Princeton was doing something, but it was serious scholarship. It was polemical. It was denominational. And by the time that the university, research university, comes along in the 1860s, 1870s, Princeton's also trying to upgrade. It's trying to have its faculty go to these institutions, even studying in Europe. Many of them do in Germany. And so Princeton does represent a model for doing Christian scholarship, at least in biblical studies and theology, that Westminster obviously tries to maintain, to imitate. And then I think that carries over into Fuller with Akinge. You get this in Marsden especially, Westminster was too narrow. Westminster wouldn't serve the purposes that Akinge had in mind, but Princeton, old Princeton, just might. So Fuller in some ways was modeled to be the Princeton Seminary of the West.
Mm-hmm.
So Machen kind of acts as a transitional figure here for keeping alive a scholarly tradition from old Princeton that some of these younger neo-evangelical figures will take out to Fuller.
Well, that's,
and, you know, go ahead.
That's what I was so interested in reading Marsden's book after reading Strand's. And in both of them, though, in the quotations and the correspondence they bring up from these neo-evangelicals who do go on to found Fuller Seminary, but also have aspirations of founding a new Christian university and other things. When they're looking at the seminary space particularly, they realize the weaknesses and the failures of Princeton and the loss or erosion of inerrancy in evangelicalism and the battle that's on the front. But it's interesting that they always, in their correspondence and in their fundraising and development, are urging people that they need to have a place that will hold on to inerrancy. But they never mention Westminster as an option at the time.
Right.
And it's because it doesn't fit the mold of what they're attempting to do. And there might have been people at Westminster early on. In fact, you know, there were people in the OPC maybe early on who wanted to have that cultural influence and to have a broader appeal. But as soon as their gaze turned away from the enemies out there and turned into their recently formed, you know, companions within the church or within the seminary institution, they started to realize they had deeper differences. Perhaps they were together with each other on inerrancy and on the gospel, but when they look at, you know, how the church should relate to the culture, for example, they started to realize, oh, We're either going to be out there trying to influence culture and win the culture wars, or we're going to be, you know, with pilgrims and militants. And these two don't get along very often.
Well, and this is where I think the Dutch side of things, too, is in some ways missing. And it's striking that Strand begins his book, the very introduction, which is in some ways odd because it's a long way from, well, it seems to be a long way from where he's going to go. So he starts the very first line of the introduction with Alvin Plantinga, a world famous philosopher. Now you can understand why he wants to go there, because he wants to show in some ways that what he's, the story he's going to tell is going to lead to fruit like Alvin Plantinga.
Mm-hmm.
But the Dutch, I mean, the Dutch model of the free university that Abraham Kuyper established in the 1880s, and that whole Dutch Calvinist notion of the pillarization of society. So Kuyper wasn't about having one cultural model for the Netherlands. He was open to, and he wanted to encourage Roman Catholics to have their institutions, Calvinists to have their institutions, humanists and liberals to have their institutions. And this would be a pilloried, you know, society. There'd be these pillars. You know, you'd go from your Calvinist school to your Calvinist trade union to your Calvinist newspaper to your Calvinist cafeteria. I mean, and I met some Dutch people over time who grew up in that world and thought it was a little parochial, but still that was a kind of model. In some ways you can read Westminster's founding, having as many Dutch people there, as reflecting that sort of mindset. We're going to have our own institutions, and we're not going to worry about the broader society per se. We're going to have Christian day schools. You know, Van Til helps to start that phenomenon. Right, in OP circles and the like, and this is just a carryover from that Dutch tradition, as opposed to what Marsden knows very well, and I think he sees Fuller much more through the lens of New School Evangelicalism, which was a much more nationalist unifying program coming out of the antebellum era that would unify all Americans with a common frame of reference, common schools, the public schools, and the like, and you know, Fuller. And Strand brings this up, but Hockingay's address at the opening of Fuller is all about Western civilization, preserving it. This is going to be a culture-shaping institution. And you know, I think in some ways he's hoping the nation, at a very pivotal time, just after World War II, will look to institutions like Fuller for leadership in the moral and social and cultural questions that are coming to the fore. And again, that, I mean, Machen and I think most of the faculty at Westminster saw Westminster with a much narrower purpose, which was to serve the cause of the gospel and to produce ministers who would minister that gospel. And there would be trickle down. It wasn't as if, you know, people couldn't take that message in, members of churches couldn't use that in other walks of life. But the institution itself had a limited understanding.
Now, Hockingay was just one of several, but this neo-evangelical movement and as this evangelical mind awakens, there were several, Hockingay, E.J. Carnell, others, who had almost a systematic approach and a concerted effort to accomplish, you know, PhDs, to earn advanced degrees at respected institutions, and then go on to found new institutions and in some ways build empires that would support this overall effort, didn't they?
But yes, and I mean it's a remarkable phenomenon that happens in the 40s, 30s and 40s, with so many evangelical or conservative Protestant people showing up in Harvard or Boston area, where, you know, Hockingay is the pastor. And I couldn't tell if all of the people like Gerstner, Carnell, if they're all worshiping at Park Street or not.
Yeah,
but
I didn't know either.
It's an amazing constellation of people who show up there. Now, part of it, I think, is just the fact that if you're going to be, if you're going to want to teach in higher education, whether seminary level or university or college, you've got to get a PhD. That's just that's the new game. When Machen was preparing to teach, you didn't have to have a PhD. PhDs were still relatively rare in seminary circles. They were coming along, but so in some ways it's not necessarily an indication. I don't think that these men were so gifted or ambitious, which I think they were. I'm not diminishing that, but it's also just the reality of American higher education. If you're going to professionalize, you've got to have a professional degree.
Was the DD the equivalent before, at least the terminal degree for a divinity student?
Well, the terminal would have been, the THD.
A THD.
I think. But those were, and I don't know the history of that degree well enough to know how many they were giving out back then. But it's an amazing development that so many of the people who go through Boston area, Cambridge with Harvard, also wind up in this mix of neo-evangelical scholars. Now, I do wonder if Strand includes too many people here, as if they're all fitting together relatively neatly, when in fact he's got mainly the story of Fuller and Christianity Today, the scholars associated with that, and the scholars associated with the founding of ETS. Those are all important outlets for these that Akinkay and Henry had a hand in. And you can refer to Gerstner, or you can refer to Wilbur Smith and the like. People, and Wilbur Smith did teach at Fuller, but sometimes the pieces don't all fit together well.
Mm. What about this failed founding of Crusade University? There's some really interesting things here, and some questions about what might have been.
Right.
I couldn't help but wonder how this all fit into Wheaton College, and what at the time were, Wheaton's definitely in the news now. We were just talking about that before recording. But what at this period made Wheaton to be not an option for these people?
Wheaton in 1926, I think, has roughly 300 students.
Mm.
This is about the time that Buswell is starting there, James Oliver Buswell, who was a conservative Presbyterian, part of the OPC for a while, and then eventually left with McIntyre in 1937 to form the Bible Presbyterian Synod. And Buswell really upgrades Wheaton's profile during this time. His tenure was, I think, roughly 1925 to 1940. By 1936, Wheaton's student body is about 900,
wow.
Which doesn't, anybody can maybe, get students to come for a variety of reasons. But still, that's during the Depression. He also helps to get the school accredited in 1931, which may not be that big a deal either, because accreditation is still a relatively new phenomenon. But if Buswell is at Wheaton, it may look like it's too fundamentalist to these guys.
Yeah.
And by the 40s, when the discussions of the university are happening, the next president at Wheaton is a man of Edmund, I believe, is his name. So you have Buswell as president. He's much more the intellectual force, and the library at Wheaton is named after Buswell. And the chapel at Wheaton is named after the next president, Edmund, the pietist. And that's a pretty good characterization of both men. But it also means that the intellectual was associated with fundamentalism.
Uh-huh.
And that's maybe something that these guys didn't want. But also, the kind of firepower and room you need, say, for a university is not something you can easily add on to a college. So I can in some ways understand that. What I don't understand, and maybe it's there but Strand doesn't bring it out, is why they didn't look to the Free University in Amsterdam as a model. Now, it's a very different set of institutional structures, European nations versus the United States, but still, the bottom line was really the bottom line. They didn't have the bucks for it. And it's interesting too. One of the other aspects of the Machen story that's kind of a backdrop to this is that the Dutch Calvinists and the folks at Westminster and the OPC are working on a university in the 30s and 40s as well. They're trying to do a reform university. The Widener Estate in Elkins Park was a mansion that they bought for this university, thinking that they might be able to pull it off. And that has repercussions in the OPC because Ed Ryan, who was one of the secretary for kind of leading the charge on this, he may have gotten ahead of himself in raising money and perhaps making promises to people he couldn't pay off. And so he may have had to leave the OPC, as Van Til said, one step ahead of the law. Anyway, I mean, there's that
and the membership dues
right. There's that wrinkle in all this, but it's interesting that the evangelical world, these new evangelicals are working on a university model at roughly the same time that Calvinists are also, people between Westminster and Calvin College and Calvin Seminary are thinking about this. And both come to naught because, again, it's a very expensive proposition to do a university.
Even by today's dollars, it was an inordinate amount they needed, and that was 60 years, 70 years ago. It was crazy amounts of money.
And I had not known that they had chosen the name Crusade University for this. Mm. That to me was unbelievable. I mean, right now, of course, we're much more sensitive to the word crusade.
Well, Wheaton even changed their mascot into to the Thunder.
Right.
They were the Crusaders.
But still, yeah, I mean, were they hoping to capture some of Billy Graham's popularity? You know, because he was leading these evangelistic crusades all over the world. So were they trying to tie into that? It's just a curious name for university. But
well, and Graham also has been. You know, influential at Wheaton. His name's been attached to it for various reasons, but
yes,
it was interesting to me too. They were also appealing to him for this new university, which seemed as if it might be in some ways a competitor.
Right. Right.
But, it was working until it didn't, and they weren't able to pull it off. What do you think that did for the movement as a whole? Do you think they found their limit? Do you think it was demoralizing for the neo-evangelical movement? I mean, they seem to be steamrolling for a while, just building and creating new institutions, and then they were unable to pull this one off. Did many give up, or did they just turn their attention elsewhere?
I guess the way I would read it is I'm not sure that they knew what they were really up to. And I mean, it made sense in a way if you want to be intellectually inclined to reach for a university. But I still think there was a naivete about that, especially about what is a university for. A university, at least in the modern research university sense, is a place where you do certain academic projects for the sake of themselves, not necessarily. I mean, you could, as a Christian, do that as your vocation to the glory of God, yes. But it's not necessarily going to pay off today.
Right.
I mean, if you hire some sociologist or someone who studies German grammar or whatever, it's not obvious how these things are going to pay off for Billy Graham, for church life, for leading people to the gospel, even for sanctification. You know, it's a very high level of inquiry. And now, you know, the world has gone on long before universities came along, and people got along without universities. I'm not trying to sell them as if this is now some breakthrough and humanity has entered into a better place because of universities.
Yeah.
But there's still important institutions that support really technical, difficult, and not always obviously utilitarian work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that they necessarily understood that. Even though they had gone to universities, I mean, Akinge himself is pursuing a PhD while he's a pastor. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but he's not necessarily kind of hanging out in the university, figuring out how it works, seeing he's not aspiring for academic jobs.
Right.
I mean, to be a president of a seminary is a very different thing from even being a dean of a
department,
arts
or
and sciences,
yeah,
college, mm-hmm, or whatever. So I guess I do think that this project of creating university reflected a kind of innocence, and it may have been finally a wake up call to trying to do something on a more limited scale, such as, you know, a magazine like Christianity Today that originally was trying to be more intellectual in its approach,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, having Fuller Seminary and also having a society of evangelical theological scholars. You know, maybe that was a way at least to try to enliven the evangelical mind, as it were. But
overall, with this book, you know, what do you think its strengths were, one? And secondly, who do you think might be served in reading this at this point in time?
I think its primary strength is actually to raise the topic of intellectual life.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of to call evangelicals to that. I don't know where that argument is these days, not being at an evangelical institution, although I have a lot of evangelical students here at Hillsdale College. But I think that aspiring to doing intellectual work is a valuable thing. It's not the only valuable thing, but it's a valuable thing. And I think Strand, in calling that, especially people in the New Calvinist world or the Southern Baptist world, to that is a useful thing. I wish he tried to think through more what intellectual life is, what the life of the mind involves. I don't think it's simply, there are times when he makes it seem like it's simply about thinking, and everybody thinks, you know, I mean, and so some people think better than others. Some people think really well. And it's even the case that academics who think a lot don't think well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, at least about things outside their own expertise. But, you know, so having a disciplinary, meaning an academic discipline aspect to your intellectual work, you're going to make a contribution to this field, is something that I don't think he addresses enough.
Mm.
I think it's more a question of intellectual life is important, or ideas have consequences, which is the name of a Richard Weaver book from the 40s as well. And I think that's true. Ideas do have consequences. And I think it's especially true that pastors and theologians need to be trained well to think carefully about things. And even, you know, as you well know, the study of scripture and theology is a rigorous enterprise.
Yeah.
You it's not just simply you can read the Bible, have warm feelings, and come up with, you know, the right understanding of it. No. But here again is where I wish he had thought more about the Alvin Plantinga with whom the book starts. I mean, it seems to me that the Calvin, you know, I guess the last time I was on one of your programs, I was saying very nice things about Dutch Calvinists, and I'm not used to doing that. Don't worry, I haven't changed, but I continue.
You've been living in Michigan too long, though.
Well, that may be. But I continue to marvel at the kind of resources that the CRC, Christian Reformed Church, and Dutch Calvinists put into the life of the mind. And I'm a beneficiary of it almost every day here because of the common interlibrary loan system we have in Michigan.
Yeah.
And so many of the books that I want that our own library does not have are coming to me from Calvin. And you know, Alvin Plantinga was steeped in something that was very different, it seems to me, from the world in which that nurtured Ockenguy or Henry. And you know, and Plantinga went on to be has gone on to be an incredible scholar in a field that is in some ways, you know, only tangentially related to theology and preaching. But yet, you know, the kind of intellectual resources, intellectual programs that the CRC and Calvin put together that kind of nurtured a man like that is one way you can have a payoff. So the interesting thing to me would be to say how many of the people that were coming through Ockenge's church or reading Christianity Today and maybe going to Fuller, but then went on to study, who knows, you know, not theology or Bible, as important those are, but actually made a contribution in fields other than theology and Bible. I mean, that to me is a real test case. And I don't know that Strand pays sufficient attention to that, but still calling attention to the kind of institutions that contribute to the life of the mind, I think is one of the strengths.
Maybe that would be a follow-up volume. If this is the awakening of the evangelical mind, maybe you have a burgeoning or a triumph or something,
right,
for the evangelical mind. Would be interesting to see their progeny, intellectual progeny, where they are today and whether or not their original vision has actually come true or if something else happened.
Right.
I enjoyed the book. Really appreciate your thoughts on this. It's worth the read, although, of course, there's definitely are some other books that are good to read along with it. For me, I very much enjoyed Marsden's Reforming Fundamentalism, that history of Fuller, and then several books by Mark Knoll on the evangelical mind and the history of this era. They're certainly well recommended, and Daryl, of course, has all sorts of books. Of all of your books, Daryl, which would you pair with this? With this era.
Oh, I actually think I'm kind of high on this book. I shouldn't be because it's my own book. But the University Gets Religion, Religious Studies in American Higher Education.
Yes.
Which is a book that was kind of a companion. I mean, I got started on that through a postdoc with George Marsden at Duke when he was working on his big book on the soul of the American university. But it's a story of how mainline Protestants got back into the universities, and it's kind of a reversal of the secularization of higher education. And it's happening, and religion departments are happening in roughly the same time that Fuller is getting started. So it's the liberal Protestant version of this, but with a much more of a university academic discipline setting. So anyway.
Well, that's that. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Daryl's work or read up on what he's doing, you can visit oldlife.org. He's also got a blog on Pathos. How often do you write over there?
I'm supposed to write twice a week.
Twice a week. So
yeah. So I try to comply.
Well, there we go. So there's a lot of places, and of course you can follow him on Twitter at oldlife. Always some interesting things there. Really appreciate what you've been up to, Daryl. Thanks for taking the time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Cameron.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been the Reformed Media Review. Pick up and read.